So let's see. First, some people have asked, what's the difference between my book and the two CD things? And I told Chris that I really, even though I have a business background, particularly in this framework, I really reflexively err away from commercialism. So that's, you know, part of my reluctance here. To me, this is like a temple. You know, we make it a temple. We make it sacred ground by what we do. And so in that frame, you know, you're not commercial in the temple. That said, so the book's pretty straightforward. The subtitle says what it aims to be, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. The first CD is done with my friend and teaching partner, a neurologist. Those are the Meditations to Change Your Brain. And there are just a number of practices there with some background information. The other product, the blue one, Stress Proof Your Brain, was done just by me alone and is based on later material, some of which is not in the book. Again, a lot of practices, some information, including about how the brain is very vulnerable to stress. We're not going to talk very much about that in here. That's more like in other workshops I do. Or, as I should have said in the very beginning, there are tons of resources on my website. So you can get there through buddhasbrain.com. Also, the Institute I founded has its own website. There are tons of resources, including the slide sets for many workshops I've given, including on topics like equanimity or basically how stress can ruin your life and what you can do about it. So anyway, that blue CD set is about that. The truth is there's a fair amount of, not overlap in the material, but the general territory. And I think each CD is about one-third talking and about two-thirds guided practices. So that would be what I would say about it. Okay. And then someone asked me a question that's a great question, which is, remember the model I did earlier, the three steps or phases? You know, basically summarized in six words, you know, let be, let go, let in, right? Be with it, hold it in awareness. Two, release it. Three, replace it. And I commented in passing that sometimes people really need to build up resources from the third phase before they can truly be with what's there, right? Because it's overwhelming. Or just the act of presencing their own experience is alarming to people. If in the first step of the three steps of taking in the good, let a good fact become a good experience. Many people get stuck at the first step because for them, you know, they are uncomfortable accessing their experience, right? Especially if experience has been hell. Why would you ever want to open that door? Just live above the neck for the rest of your life, right? In a sense. So it's important to really get at this fundamental prior question. It's a great question. What are some of the resources that actually allow people to be mindful? One resource is the felt sense of someone with you who loves you. The felt sense of someone with you who cares. Whoever that is. For many people, it's an animal companion. And even if that's hard to access, the felt sense of being with someone who cares about you, the felt sense of being with someone you care for. Because those use overlapping neural systems. Giving and receiving love use overlapping neural systems. A remarkable finding is if you want to prolong the lifespan of people in an old folks' home, give them a tomato plant to take care of. Literally, studies show you improve survival and longevity if you give people a tomato plant in an old folks' home. They get interested in it. It gives them something to talk about. The will to live rises. They want to see those tomatoes grow. They think about giving the tomatoes to their grandkids or whatever it is. They want to live longer. They use overlapping systems. So either of those, the felt sense or the knowing even that someone's with you, can help people bear the difficult things. I think about Dante's Inferno, right? The poet Dante went into hell with the angel Virgil by his side. You know, or as they say in AA, the mind is a dangerous neighborhood. Never go in alone. That's a great one. It's a great one. So those are two, I think, social resources. Another is to start with physical pleasure. It's very interesting that even people who are severely depressed can access physical pleasure, which is you have to almost destroy the brain to eliminate its capacity to experience physical pleasure, whatever that is, whether it's for some people the taste of chocolate. I had a depressed client the one pleasure in her day was a double handful of chocolate chips. And I said, wow, that's a lot of sugar. She said, yeah, but it's the only good thing I do in my day.
Wow.
And I knew it was. So, okay. All right. So, physical pleasure. What gives people physical pleasure, and can you be mindful of the physical pleasure? That most people will let themselves do that. The smell of an orange, the taste of food, the feeling of a shower, a glass of water when they're thirsty, just some kind of basic physical pleasure is a real pathway, I think, into mindfulness. Sometimes I think, this has really been true for me, with my clients and my kids too, we ask too much of people, and we haven't done the fundamentals. It reminds me when I learned to play, or I didn't really learn, that's the point. When I started playing the clarinet when I was in sixth grade in the state system, I did it for about 6 weeks, and I just skipped over the scales because they were kind of boring, you know, and I jumped to the exciting stuff, but I couldn't do it because I didn't have the basics, so I got bored and gave it up. I got frustrated and gave it up. You know, so I think going back to the fundamentals, always go back to the fundamentals. I think of the Buddha, you know, mindfulness of breathing. That's what he did. He would practice mindfulness of breathing. Enlightened, he would practice mindfulness of breathing. Then I'll do one more thing, which I point out to people, which is that they can actually observe in their experience, and sometimes it helps to work with something like sound. Sound is really good this way. That very simply, things move through awareness. Right? We're aware of sounds coming and going. We see sights. We just turn our head. Turn your head. You'll see different sights moving by. Or things bubble up from inside. So there are contents in awareness. And they come and they go. And some of them are very pleasant. Fields of daffodils, you know, Wordsworth, whatever. But then on the other hand, some are pretty awful. But the interesting thing is that no matter what comes and goes, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, wonderful or awful, it never changes awareness itself. Awareness itself, which I think of as the representing capacity of the nervous system, particularly to represent contents to itself in a recursive kind of way, right? Itself is never harmed by what passes through. It's a little bit like a TV. You know, the TV represents things on the screen. It could show beautiful, you know, meadows with flowers, or it could show, you know, war scenes. But in either case, the capacity of the TV to show those pictures has never changed. And so, to point out to people that you can be aware of things, but the awareness, the knowing, if you will, itself is not harmed by what passes through it. So you literally can take a kind of refuge in awareness itself. You see? And what's nice about that is it's a simple and obvious thing you can see directly. You can see, yeah, no matter what passes through, I can still be aware. Nice things can pass through, I'm still aware. Horrible things pass through, I can still be aware. And then people can increasingly start taking refuge in awareness, right? And disidentify increasingly from the contents. Because as Ajahn Chah said, who is kind of the godfather of the Western stream of mindfulness, including London Insight, you know, the Vipassana traditions, he said, basically, the contents of mind are transient and empty and onerous. You know, they're transient. They're transient. And they don't have to have an owner. They just move on through. And something as esoteric as that can be observed directly by people who are just at the very beginning of mindfulness. And it's kind of weird, but they can see it. So I like this. It's immediately obvious, and it's as profound as it gets.
Rick, could you say those three? Because I think some people didn't hear the three aspects. Transient.
Oh, transient means impermanent and changing. Then you can just see that. It's an endless show, you know. The second thing is that whatever arises, arises dependently. Like we think of what we think, or we hear what we hear, we see what we see, or we feel what we feel, we sense what we sense, based on causes, right? So, everything kind of is related to everything else. And last, there doesn't need to be an owner. That's tomorrow's workshop. You know, the ownerlessness of the contents of mind. They don't have to be owned. They don't have to be claimed. People don't have to identify. They don't have to collapse the distance between the observer and the movie screen, as I said earlier. Anyway. Okay. All right, now for the bad news. All right, here we go. Ready? Bad news, greed, hatred, heartache, and delusion. Oh, boy. So we've gone from the loving brain and a pretty picture, you know, la-di-da, you know, it's a small world after all, whatever. People who love people. My wife says, honey, we pay you not to sing. Okay. So anyway, so we got from this to greed, hatred, heartache, and delusion. So it's interesting that, just as a detail, you know, in Buddhism, we talk about the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. And I've been very struck by the degree to which the Buddha left out relational pain. It's very interesting if you think about it. The kinds of issues that Westerners typically grapple with, you know, why can't I be loved? Or why won't they receive my love? Often the greatest heartache is they won't take our love. Our love is legit, it's genuine, it's not a Trojan horse, okay, but they won't receive it. You know, that's often the greatest pain, isn't it? That we can't express. Thwarted contribution. As a sidebar, I think that's one reason why teenagers often in Western societies are troubled, because they don't have much chance to contribute. You know, we send them off to these kind of reservations, schools and malls. I don't know if you have malls in England, but whatever the equivalent is. You know, and then we say, gee, we want you to give up sex, drugs, and rock and roll for 10 long years at least so you can have a life like ours. You're like, what? Anyway, so why did the Buddha leave out heartache? Now, so that's an interesting speculation. I won't go far along that line. But I think that there are three fundamental systems, right? Hatred relates to the avoiding system. Remember those three systems I talked about? Motivational systems. Aversion, we avoid what's aversive, right? Then we approach what's pleasant. So we avoid the unpleasant. We approach the pleasant. Okay. But then on top of that, in ways that I think that are clearly complex and neurologically, anatomically, are distinct from the more primitive avoiding and approaching systems, we also want to attach to us. We want to join with us. Okay? And so then, if we get the object of our approaching, if we attain what we approach, we feel satisfied and happy. Also, if we can steer clear of the sticks that we want to avoid, right, we feel relieved, feel safe. If we gain the objects of our attaching, we feel love, we feel connection, we feel belonging, right, we feel, appreciated and so forth, good. On the other hand, if we don't attain that, what do we feel? We feel hearted, we feel narcissistically wounded, we feel separated, we feel bereft, we feel abandoned, rejected. Devalued, and so forth. It is curious that that third category, which is a very, very prominent category in human life, you find almost no mention of in the Dharma. Maybe because the Buddha lived at a time where, as someone said over there, relationship was so embedded in the culture. You know, he lived in India. The example of India. Maybe it's because he was a really introverted guy. Maybe it was because he was such an introverted guy, he was willing to leave his wife and newborn, and go off and, practice, which he did. You know, he abandoned his wife and baby. His wife died either in childbirth or shortly after. Rahula, his name is Fetter. It's interesting. You've got to come to terms with this in the tradition.
What is the name?
Rahula, which means Fetter. His son was named Rahula, which means fetter.
Oh, why is it?
Fetter. Fantastic Swiss tennis player. I don't mean Federer. Fetter. Fetter. There we go. Ball and chain. Now, that's pretty intense, right? So we got to include that, in an honest way when we think about all this stuff. So I don't know exactly why, but that said, I think it's a very provocative and interesting question. And part of what I've tried to do is to kind of think this through, use the profound and core principles of the Dharma and extend it into the relational sphere as well. And that's part of what we're doing here today. Yeah?
I've always felt that grief is part of the next steps as well.
Grief?
Would you connect that to grief?
I think grief a lot there are different kinds of grief. I think you're saying for most people grief, I suspect you're implying it, is a relational emotion. Yeah, loss of a loved one. Rather than grief, let's say, at being unable to fulfill a goal, right? Just independent of, other people. Yeah, you're right, grief. You don't hear that very much either. You hear the Buddha talking a lot. The Buddha talks a lot about social emotions that are aversive or approach focused. In other words, he talks a lot about hatred, anger, ill will. If you think about it, it's interesting that in wise intention, right intention, okay, which is one of the eight elements of the Eightfold Path, two out of three of what are the wise intentions have to do with aversion. The wise intentions are non-harming and non-ill will. And the other one's renunciation. Two on hatred, one on greed. Isn't that interesting? He spent a lot of time. I mean, one of my main teachers is named Christina Feldman, who I think a lot of you know. I think she's really, I was going to say a rock star, but this rock star, Christina Feldman, somehow don't go together. I don't know. She's very, part of what's wonderful about her, she's very humble and real. But anyway, so, you know, there's a lot there. And he also, of course, talks about lust very often in the phrase of trying to calm down these young male monks. You know, there's a lot of talk about lust, which is a social emotion as well. So, yeah, you're right. That's left out. There was a person here, then I'll move on.
I was just going to say that heartache is part of greed and aversion, isn't it?
What is?
That heartache is part of greed and aversion or delusion. I mean, it just slots in, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
I know what you mean about it not being specifically mentioned, but...
Right.
That's how I...
Yeah.
I can slot it into...
That's right.
...greed, aversion, and delusion.
Yeah, I've pushed on that on myself in that regard. You know, hey, Rick, are you just inventing a fourth category that doesn't need to be there? One thing is true, but at the end of the day, I'll just like say this and then move on, but I think at the end of the day, we can feel that there's something about heartache that's of its own world in addition to the frustration or loss we feel when we can't get a goodie we want, mm-hmm. right? Or when we're dealing with a physically unpleasant situation. You know, there's something about the social realm that I think it's honest. I think it's appropriate to say that it truly has kind of a life of its own. You know, that's my own personal view because I'm still working with this, but I do think it is, and if nothing else, it's like play. Let's play with it in terms of this. But yeah. Okay, so here's a great question. What's the nature of the brain when a person's enlightened? What's the brain of an arhat? Was, you know, Zen master, Zen mistress, whatever. You know, what's the nature of that brain? Or dialing it down a little bit, but still very positively. You know, what's the nature of the brain when a person is experiencing inner peace? Or they have really come home? Or they're self-actualizing? Or they're having a peak moment, you know? What's going on in that brain? It gets at other questions like, is the brain naturally enlightened or awake? Is there a natural wakefulness to the brain? Or do we have to struggle uphill, you know, trying to transform this brain into something else? Well, I think that the evidence is clear that the home base of the human brain, in terms of these three systems, is very positive. In other words, when people are not disturbed, when they're not attacked, when they're not in pain, when they're not hungry, when they're not assaulted, when they're not chemically troubled, okay? They default, in terms of these three systems, to calm, contentment, and caring. For example, the parasympathetic nervous system, which is kind of does calm and so forth, is balanced by the sympathetic nervous system in the brain. The sympathetic nervous system is a fight-or-flight stress response system. It gets a lot of glamour. You know, it gets a lot of news, a lot of press. As they say in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads. Okay, that's the sympathetic nervous system. But if you cut the nerve tracts, for various reasons, someone's so ill, has such a serious disease, you need to do that. If you cut the tracts that support the sympathetic nervous system, the person will continue living. But if you cut the tracks of the parasympathetic nervous system, they stop breathing. Their heart stops breathing. Parasympathetic activation is really fundamental. Same way, most people would say when they're not hungry, when they're not in pain, they're not thirsty, they're not, you know, being attacked or rattled by something, experience mild contentment, mild baseline well-being. Also, I think as well, when people are not threatened, when they're not feeling their territories encroached upon, or they don't have access to the resources they need, they default to a state of caring. Kind of Dana economy, the natural economy of generosity given and received. I think that's the nature of the brain. With creativity as a kind of an emergent property that comes out of all three of us. You know, most of us are in midlife. Some of us are in early middle age. Some of us are in late middle age. I think I'm in early, late middle age myself. You know, I'm not quite ready to go into that dark night, whatever. But, you know, you may know Eric Erickson's stage theories of adult development. The issue in middle age, midlife, is generativity, which is creativity here, versus stagnation. It's really important to be generative, whether it's taking care of a tomato plant, you know, or, you know, learning a new way to make chicken, or starting a project, or figuring out, you know, some way to help people, taking a petition in some area. Okay. So if you look at a picture here, this is an image of these three systems, approaching, attaching, and avoiding. And when we're in the natural state, we're in what I would call a responsive mode. In other words, the brain doesn't just stop in an arhat, arhat being the fourth stage of enlightenment in the Buddhist tradition. Or imagine other traditions, a Christian saint, or, you know, a Muslim imam, a great master, a shamanic. The contemplative traditions are in the indigenous peoples as well. You know, whatever, imagine whoever you would like as an example of awakening, as a realization. You know, they're really at the top of the mountains there. Their brain doesn't stop. They still feel pain. They still have that avoiding system in there. They still have an approaching system. They still have an attaching system. The question is not whether those systems go away. The question is, what's their mode of operation? And this, for me, is a very useful way to think about this question of what's our true nature. Because it has to do with the mode of operating. So I think this is the mind of an arhat, but also this is the mind of any person who drops into this way of being, where they're not disturbed, when they're characterized by gladness, love, and peace. Gladness or gratitude, love and peace. And earlier today, many times today, you've dropped into this mode. Partly we don't recognize it, because it's not glamorous and it's not upset. We're not upset in it. It is literally like the sky. We notice the cloud. We notice the storm cloud. But we don't tend to notice the sky. But this is the ground, you know. Negativity is like figure. This is like the ground. I like this quote here because I'm a Tolkien fan. And, you know, it's the question that even though our responsive mode, the resting state, the default of the brain, may be temporarily obscured, it's never not there. In other words, it's always there at some deep level, even without resort to anything transcendental. That's why I like this quote, you know, which at the darkest moment here, you may know this point, Sam and Frodo are crawling up the slopes of Mount Doom, and it's just getting about as bad as it can get. They're completely worn out. They're at the end of their strength. And at that moment, you know, through the clouds produced by, you know, Sauron, the bad guy, every great novel needs a great villain, right? He's the great villain. Sam sees through the clouds the stars that are still forever there. In the same way, our own true nature may be obscured by the clouds of greed, hatred, heartache, and delusion, or at least greed, hatred, and delusion, but the true nature is there, even if it's obscure. That's the natural state. There are lots of benefits in the natural state. In itself, it's a pleasant experience. It also neurologically, or kind of neurobiologically, is how we refuel after we expend. It's like there are two great rhythms. We expend and we refuel. And I want to be clear, there's a place for revving up. There's a place for moving out of the sort of responsive, quiet mode and cheering our team on or dealing with an emergency or ramping up to get something done, finish that art piece, finish that book, get that quarterly report out of work, whatever. And there's a place for that. But after we expend, as she said, we've got to refuel. Otherwise, we don't have anything to give. You know, we start running on fumes, running on empty. Okay? Also, this responsive mode really promotes pro-social behaviors. People are much more inclined toward generosity and patience and, you know, making connections and so forth with others when their own cup runneth over. I really like this quote from Bertrand Russell because one impediment, one obstruction that sometimes arises around this sort of territory is the idea that it's selfish. that taking care of me somehow means I'm not also taking care of you. But actually, as it turns out, taking good care of ourselves is a very wonderful way to take care of other people. As he says, you know, the good life is a happy one, not because good people are happy people, but because if you're happy, it will make you good. But now here's the bad news. To survive, we leave home. If the responsive mode is our home base, Mother Nature developed hair trigger mechanisms that send us running from home at the least crackle of a twig in the jungle of the Serengeti or the woodlands of the Serengeti 2-3 million years ago, or today with a frown across the dinner table. Right? Or someone making a rude gesture with a finger in one of their hands while you're driving in traffic next to them. A book. Or you see someone on TV whose politics you don't like. Right? Suddenly, there you went, wham. Or as they say, you know, in enlightenment circles, you think you're so enlightened? Go home and visit the parents for the holidays. Go home for the holidays. You know? So we get triggered. And that's the reactive mode of the brain. A kind of inner homelessness in a sense. Right? So the brain in two modes. You can see, you know, this is a graphic of the reactive mode. It's the same systems, but they're just tipped into a different way of moving. Okay? So it's useful to watch oneself, and you can feel it actually increasingly. I'm in this mode when I'm doing this, and then I'm triggered into that, and then I recover and kind of come back home again, and things get settled, especially after a nice long bubble bath and so forth, and scratching my partner's back or whatever, getting that nice stress relief benefit. And then something else happens. I get a phone call, now I'm in reactive mode, then I try to recover from that. Okay. A lot of what we're doing in practice and in life, frankly, because the reactive mode is unpleasant. It doesn't feel very good. You know, maybe there's some short-term gain, like getting angry has a certain energy to it, but long-term it just doesn't feel good. So we're basically, in practice, in a sense, we're trying to increase the rate of recovery from the reactive mode, how quickly we get back, and we're trying to make our engagement with the reactive mode more shallow. And we're trying to deepen our responsive mode. Because the more time we clock in the responsive mode, the deeper the neural circuits we build. In other words, it's like creating, I think, of a deeper and deeper keel in the water. So that as we, in effect, we take the fruit as the path when we're in the responsive mode. Because when we're in the responsive mode, we're stimulating its neural substrates. And because, in other words, when we stimulate its neural substrates, we are strengthening them. Because neurons that fire together wire together. See that core idea? Taking the fruit as the path? I think it's a wonderful. It's like good news. You know, the more time we clock in a good place, the more inclined the mind is, the more the mind takes the shape of that which it rests upon, so it becomes increasingly inclined in that direction. It stays there longer. And it's harder to knock it out. Because we are very, very, very easily tipped out of the responsive. Okay. So one main way we do that is to form this distinction between us and the reactive mode. In other words, as soon as people start making separation, studies have shown that if you assign people to two different groups kind of arbitrarily, very quickly they start thinking that they're better than the other group and start making absurd rationales for why they're better. And then if you set it up at all, that they are threatened in their group by anything, that other group starts looking like an easy target. And if you also manipulate it further, and you think that that other group is somehow attacking you, oh boy, you know, we're ready to go. There's a fairly, to me, profound Native American teaching in which the way I heard it was that this old woman was asked toward the end of her life how she had become so respected, so loved, right, so listened to. And she said, well, it's because I know that in my heart are two wolves, one of love and one of hate, and I know that everything depends on which one I feed each day. That's it right there, right? Which one? Pulling weeds or planting flowers? Which wolf do we feed every day? The wolf of love, I think, the evidence is clear, is primary. Right? The ground, if you will, is cooperation, relatedness, in 10,000 little ways that we hardly notice. It is literally the field of cooperative relatedness is the water we swim in, hardly knowing that we're wet. But that wolf of hate is very fast. And as soon as there's any kind of separation, it gets up off its little mat and starts looking for someone to bite. And as soon as you feel threatened, okay, bam, it is after that target. That's the wolf of hate. And in human evolution, it's very poignant, but it's very true, that in effect, the wolf of love and the wolf of hate co-evolved. Lots of studies show this, that as hunter-gatherer bands got better at teamwork inside their band, they got better at attacking and exploiting others. And as they got better at attacking and exploiting other bands, they were more able to bring resources into their own band, which improved their likelihood of passing on their genes. No one lacks the wolf of hate. Trying to kill the wolf of hate feeds the wolf of hate, because you're hating the wolf of hate. Right? Who among us does not have a wolf of hate in his or her heart? And it's humbling and important. I think some of us in spiritual circles, Buddhist circles, there's a kind of denial of the wolf of hate. The wolf of hate is there. Right? Just like a denial of the capacity of the mind, the brain, to tip into a reactive mode. Right? It's not, we can't get rid of the wolf of hate. The question is, can we restrain it and starve it? The Buddha talked a lot in the language of what he called nutriments. What do we feed them? Just as that Native American elder did. What are we feeding? Are we feeding greed, hatred, heartache, and delusion, right? Or are we feeding, you know, gladness, love, and peace, and wisdom? What are we feeding? Right. Any comments or questions so far?
Yeah.
Right there first.
Yes, I just want. I agree with what you're saying. I've just been thinking of these things for quite a few years now. But sometimes it just happens that I'm thrown into depression, even though I would use all my powers. I cannot try harder.
Yeah.
To feed the good things in and to.
Yeah.
And for some reason, that is of no help on certain occasions, and I just have to sort of sit with it. And you know, I have no answer to it. You know, it's been a long, long time, and I have no answer. And I have been looking, you know, searching for a long time. You know, what is it? It's almost like a physical thing, and I know I'm not the only person. I know people. It is like almost like an illness.
Yeah.
I don't do the drug thing at all. I just
Yeah.
You know what?
Yeah, that's a whole thing, right? I'm gonna sit down for that one. No, can I still see over there? Yeah. Well, I feel it, and I sense that you really are practicing. Remember those three domains? You really are practicing in the mind. So what happens when we really, really, really practice in the mind, and let's say we're depressed, or we really, really practice in a sense in our mind in our relationship, and our marriage, our family, our relationship, whatever, is still very problematic. At some point, I think it's useful to look outside the domain of the mind and look at the domain of circumstances ranging from economic and structural, racial, prejudicial kinds of circumstances, as well as the body. And one thing I've really come to appreciate, honestly, is the importance of neurochemistry. You know, I've known a number of people who were very dedicated practitioners of the mind, and there was always a dampening blanket that just pushed down the trajectory of the benefits they could get from those practices, right? And that was physiology. And after they addressed physiology in one way or another, and there are many, many skillful means for physiology other than medication, right? Once they addressed physiology, then the basis was much there. It's kind of like they were trying to light a fire with wet firewood. Right? It just wouldn't ignite. But when they finally got enough tryptophan, tryptophan is the amino acid precursor of serotonin. Serotonin is very involved in mood regulation, right? Or when they got enough iron. I mean, in America, it's estimated that the majority of the female adult population is subclinically anemic. Iron is a cofactor in the transformation of tryptophan to serotonin. You don't have enough iron, you don't have enough serotonin. Vitamin B6, particularly the activated form of B6, is another cofactor in transforming tryptophan into serotonin. For example, if you don't have those, you're in trouble. Another little detail is, you could Google this or look into it, it's called the cytokine theory of depression. It's really quite interesting. It has to do with the fact that inflammatory pathways share pathways with nervous system depression. If you ever notice, like for me at least, the first I could tell I'm getting a cold when my mood starts to flatten. You notice that? It's interesting if you look at medicine, physicians' lists of all the ailments and all the diseases that are listed by symptoms, and you cross-index across all the different symptoms and see which symptoms show up most frequently. The most common symptom of all ailments is depression. Now, from an evolutionary standpoint, it kind of makes sense, because if you're sick or injured, you know, what you ought to do is hunker down and, you know, not start a new company or a disco, right? Huddle in the cave. Yeah, you're bummed out. You know, you feel like crap, but you're not dead and you can still pass on some genes, right? So it kind of makes sense in a way. And so whatever triggers inflammation, like food allergies or airborne allergens or other things that trigger an inflammatory cascade, release what are called cytokines, which are signaling molecules in the immune system. Some suppress inflammation, most are inflammatory, and they cross the blood-brain barrier and they stay in the brain. And they have all kinds of nasty effects, including sensitizing people to stress. So there are physical pathways here. I'll stop on that point. You might, if you do get our book, take a look at the appendix, which was written by my wife, who's a nutritional specialist, and you can see the research-based interventions for promoting positive neurochemistry besides medication there. But I think they're all three domains are really important. All of them really, really matter. Okay. All right. So this is a good quote. I like this one. Montagues and Capulets. Go Shakespeare. It's the idea that, you know, the circle of us is very fluid, isn't it? Right? Sometimes it includes the whole wide world. There are people who are petitioning out there to reduce global warming and so forth. You know, that's a sense of the whole world is the circle of us. For a lot of times, though, especially when we get into fights or difficulties and on, the circle of us becomes just one person. You know, me, right? I want to move through a couple things here and then move into a practice and then talk about empathy. Okay? All right. So I think this is the choice. Moment to moment a lot. And we tend to be in one mode or the other. Yeah, there can be kind of a blurring and yeah, there can be a rapid movement. But we can feel it, can't we? When we're in this more reactive mode of where, you know, we're frustrated, we're angry, we're bereft, we're lost, we're upset, even if we cover it over with a nice, you know, stiff upper lip, what have you. On the other hand, we use stiff upper lip in America too. On the other hand, are we in the responsive mode, right? Where we feel there's a kind of a natural ease. It's not perfect. We're not enlightened yet. It's not irrevocable. That's the distinction. If you're fully enlightened, it's irrevocable. You cannot go back to the reactive mode. In ways that I still do not completely understand, but I believe they're true because there are so many clear examples of this. You've blown the circuit breakers. You cannot go back to the reactive mode. I have a friend who lived in Thailand as a monk for 9.5 years, Patrick, from this program Chris and I did. And I asked him, of course, to me, the obvious question, hey, did you meet anybody who was enlightened? Right? You know? Okay. And he said two things that were very interesting to me. The first thing he said was, well, in that culture of very deep practice, monastic, forest, Thai, Buddhist practitioners, no one is going to say you're enlightened until they've kind of lived with you for about 10 years. So they've really seen it through thick and through thin. It's not like it is in the West. You know, someone has this kind of awakening on the bus, and next thing you know, they've got their own website and TV show, and, you know, all the rest of that. I don't know. I mean, I think there have been people like that, but generally in those traditions, you know, it's kind of like they're going to kick the tires for 7 years. Okay, and I said, okay, but still, were there some people that were considered really like they were just fully cooked, fully enlightened? He said, yeah, there were, or close to it, real close to it. He said, yeah, definitely. Okay, Patrick, what were they like? He said, well, two things. First, they seemed to have a lot of energy. Creativity, generativity. They were generative. Okay, they did stuff. And the second thing was that they were kind of always the same. And I'm like, what do you mean they were always the same? He said, well, you know, if you treated them well, they would really love you. And if you treated them badly, they'd really love you. In other words, their responsive mode was unconditional. It wasn't based on circumstances. It wasn't based on which way the worldly winds blew. Praise or blame, you know, gain or loss, pleasure or pain, fame or ill repute, right? Didn't really matter which way the winds blew. Their boat had such a deep keel in the water that it kept on going. And I think that's where we're going. That's where practice is taking us. And the more time we clock in that responsive mode, the more we stimulate and therefore strengthen this neural substrate. That's why I talk about here taking the fruit as the path. You know, it's kind of a win-win strategy. The more time we clock in authentic, not fake or pumped up, but real, gladness, love, and peace, much of which is fairly mild. Its intensity level is often quite mild, even if it seems to be all-pervading in the mind. So it's important, I think, not to overlook those wonderful moments just because they're mild and they don't have a lot of drama to them. The reactive mode typically has a lot of drama. The responsive mode is less drama. But the more time we clock in those states, the more we build up the substrates of it in the mind. I like this quote from Einstein, you know, who from a scientific perspective really says something quite deep about the true nature of things. He was really amazing, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. Our son did this retreat when he was a teenager. And during part of it, a girl on the retreat, a teenage girl, twisted her ankle real, real badly. So they had to take her to the hospital, the emergency room. And one of the senior monks went along, co-abbot Ajahn Pasi. And so just imagine a completely ordinary, as ordinary as you can imagine, American hospital kind of in the sticks. Community, local county hospital with this orange robe, senior monks radiating loving kindness to dad. And my son Forrest is hanging out with him, as well as some junior monk who could drive a car, and this girl. So Forrest comes back. I said, so Forrest, you know, what was that whole monastery thing like for you? And, you know, well, this, that, that. And he said, then he paused, he said, but you know, Dad, those Ajahns, they have game. That's my son, super. He said they have game. That's like an American sports expression for really, like, I thought it was very cool. I think Einstein had some serious game as well. Okay, so how about we do a little practice here? Coming home, you know, taking the first path and exploring those, seeing how that is. Then we'll segue into compassion and empathy. And then I hope, and I'm eager to actually, get into the stew of real relationship nightmares. All right, the real drama. Okay. All right. So, if you will, again, as a practice, of course, go your own way. Do what works for you. Come into yourself right here. Let me take a few breaths. I'll give you a little trick here for activating the parasympathetic nervous system and really kind of calming, is to inhale rapidly and fully and hold the inhalation, I mean, to the full extent you can inhale. Hold it for a few seconds and then exhale slowly, like on a count of roughly 10. And if you do two or three of those in a row, it's really hard not to be relaxed because the parasympathetic nervous system handles exhaling. So if you inhale super fully, you really light it up. It's telling the body, exhale, 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 and then exhale slowly over a count of 10. Okay? So, to begin with, bring to mind something that you feel grateful for or glad about. Perhaps something in your life today or something that's happened for you in the past. See if you can open to and gently encourage a growing sense of gratitude or gladness. And it's fine to move from even one thing to another, multiple things you're glad about. It's a sense of goals being attained. Wholesome desires being fulfilled. And again, if you encounter some obstruction, that's all right. Maybe a sense of frustration or disappointment. Instead of gratitude, see if you can make room for that state of mind. Take a few dozen seconds, perhaps, being aware of it, noting what it's like. What is it like to be frustrated? What is disappointment like? And then coming back to the positive focus here on gratitude and gladness. See if you can make room for gladness, for some basic sense of satisfaction or fulfillment. As you can, kind of calming, soothing any graspingness of the mind. As you can, finding your way into an attitude of mind and heart and body that is in effect like I've already been fed by life. It's a kind of mood or stance of approaching life having already been nourished by it. Okay. Allowing the sense of satisfaction or fulfillment or gratitude to settle into the background. Now, if you can, bring to mind the sense of someone who you know cares about you. Some being. And open to that knowing becoming an experience of being cared about, of being fed in your heart. As before, see if this experience can be as full as possible. In fact, giving yourself over to it. And then increasingly exploring the overlapping between feeling cared about and feeling caring yourself. You might explore moving back and forth between receiving kindness, receiving friendship, receiving camaraderie, and giving compassion, giving kindness to others. Loved and loving. Perhaps put your hand on your heart or your cheek, whatever helps you. Deepen into this sense of you as a loved and loving person coming home to that as your nature. Moving to life from the heart, already fed in the heart. And then allowing whatever sense of being loved and loving is present for you to remain in the background. Now, as you can, explore a sense of reasonable safety. In other words, let yourself feel as safe as you reasonably can here and now. In a protected setting, among good people. The growing sense of peace. A basic sense of being all right, right now. Not at war with anyone, including yourself. not threatened right now. Noticing wariness or vigilance and relaxing it. As you can, opening out to the fullest possible experience of what the Buddha called the highest happiness, which is peace. Here and now, no goals need to be pursued. No relationships need to be fixed. No threats needed to be warded off. Opening right now to the wholeness of gladness, love, and peace. If it's meaningful for you, see if you can make room in your mind for a kind of knowing that this is who I really am. Deep down, this is real me. This is my true nature. was that for you? To an extent, again, it's the jukebox at a certain basic level. We're trying to call up positive states to stimulate them, like lifting a little weight. Any single time you do it, you won't build much muscle tissue. But again and again, repeatedly, the more you do something, the more muscle tissue you build. Actually, a very interesting example, it's appropriate here. I don't know if you know this study. London taxicab drivers, at the end of their training, have a thicker hippocampus than they had at the beginning of their training, because they have to memorize the spaghetti snarl of streets here. Right? A thicker hippocampus. They used it, you know, so they stimulated it. You know, they fired it together, so they wired it together. Anyway, so that's what we're doing here. So, anything you noticed about gladness, love, and peace?
Yeah. I started off working on just one thing.
Yeah.
I don't remember what it is now.
What did you say?
I started feeling grateful for one thing.
Yes.
Yeah. And then at some stage you say go from one thing to the other.
If you want to say. Yeah.
The message I got is that you can go from one thing to the other. It was quite incredible that I came to the most obvious thing of actually feeling grateful to be alive. Which I can't say I feel that all the time. Most times I take it for granted.
Yeah.
But I was just feeling happy, just to be alive.
That's right. Just to.
I was going from one thing to the other.
Yeah, yeah. No, thank you. I got it. Yeah.
Something I noticed in this practice that I've noticed in the others that we've done so far, is actually it's very hard to maintain that. There's that, it becomes a sort of drift.
Yeah.
And then I feel I'm not exercising the muscle.
Yeah.
And it's something about, you know, our minds are so good at going over and over when it's something negative, we really stay with it. There's something about this really lovely state, and actually it's hard to maintain that brightness still.
Yes.
That's what I was finding.
That's right. And, so she was saying that it's hard to stay in these positive states, even though they're rewarding. So you would think that the brain, the mind would naturally rest there. It is unfortunately true that the brain does have this negativity bias, and it tends to get restless when it feels good, because in evolution, it was important to get carrots, right, as well as to avoid sticks. But if you did not get a carrot today, you'd have a chance of one tomorrow, usually. But if you failed to avoid a stick today, wow, no more carrots forever. So it tends to scan. Now, the tendency to scanning also is affected by temperament. Some people are more anxious than others. And then by life experiences, culture, media, politics, and all the rest of that. What a person can do increasingly is to take these positive states as objects of concentration. I mean, speaking of Christina Feldman, one thing that she did for me that served me enormously was she raised the topic of concentration, which I don't know how it is at London Insight, but in American Vipassana circles, concentration was not taught for a long time. Even though the Noble Eightfold Path, there is right concentration. It comes right after right mindfulness. So it's quite provocative to realize, related to this focus on positivity that I'm doing here. It's not that we're against the negative. We're not leaving them out, right? Nothing left out. We do the first phase of mindfulness with them. It's just that we don't want to get stuck there. Right? So anyway, of the five jhana factors, the jhanas are these non-ordinary states of awareness in the right concentration element of the Eightfold Path. The five traditional factors for these non-ordinary states of deep absorption, right? Transformative absorption, which are seen as wonderful springboards for liberating insight. Okay, so far what I'm talking about? What are the five jhana factors? Applied attention, sustained attention, bliss or rapture, and joy. Mm-hmm. And joy is on a spectrum of happiness, contentment, and tranquility. It becomes increasingly peaceful. The tranquility is on the spectrum. And then unification of awareness, which also has a certain positive affect. At least two out of five, 40%. Now, the jhana factors are intensely positive emotion. So I think that just like doing any kind of a concentration practice, what I like about concentration practice, it is like going to the gym. You either, you know, I'll be blunt here, you're either lifting the weight or bullshitting about it. You know what I mean? Right? You kind of circle the machine, you look at it. I gotta go get a drink of water first, you know, and you come back. Eh, it's all about you either do that or you're not, you know? Same thing in concentration practice. You're on the object or you're not. And here you could take a positive state, like gladness, love, and peace, as the object and just say, I'm gonna keep coming back. And if I drift away, it's okay, but I'm gonna come back. The more you come back, the deeper the groove is, the deeper the keel becomes, the more that becomes in terms of dynamic systems theory, like a strange attractor. It attracts your mind increasingly. Yeah. Yeah. I add this. I get, you know, I look at my mind and the caveman brain, cavewoman brain, and I go, I'm grateful to you, et cetera, et cetera. Now quit running my life. You know? And a little bit in me, there's a certain, like, I want to help myself have these good states of mind because I understand why I'm doing it. We don't do it because we're greedy for them. Okay, I admit it. Occasionally I love these states of mind. Give me another fix. Oh, okay, bliss, please, give me some bliss. But mainly we do it to, like the Buddha said with the raft, we don't carry the raft on the other side of the stream. We mainly do it to fill ourselves up so our happiness becomes increasingly unconditional.
How does this relate to, like, say this is a really nice experience and the mind replays it to go on continuing the good feeling? Is that going to be building up good positive feelings?
Yeah, if you're at the deep level, the brain's really mechanical. Yeah. At the highest level, it's extraordinarily sophisticated. But down at the basics, it literally is kind of mechanical and additive for better or worse. And there are variations on that. Things that are in the foreground of attention with deep absorption really are highlighted for structure building. Also, I should add, I think one of the reasons for the two of the five jhana factors being positive emotion is because positive emotions have tons of dopamine and norepinephrine as neurotransmitters, which promote synaptic formation. Those two neurotransmitters really promote synaptic formation. So again, when you're saturated in positive emotion, we're really learning from the experience. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to learn positive habits of mind and heart.
Dopamine and what's the other?
Norepinephrine, noradrenaline. It's also a stress hormone, but it's a general, I said earlier, brightening the mind. It's a general alerting and orienting. So you're right. Even if we just kind of in the back of our mind focus on the positive. I'll tell you a little story that gets at this, because the obvious question comes up right here. Hey, are we just looking at the world through rose-colored glasses?
Yeah.
Obvious. Totally legit question. And the first thing I would say is it's interesting that people who are deep in practice, they seem to have enormous compassion, first of all. And second, they have an acute awareness of what's going on around them. So it's not like they're just living in la-la land. I'm sure there are a few people living in la-la land. Okay, fine. But most people, the further along their practice, the more they tend to be compassionate and engaged with the world. The other thing is I think we're trying to get to a place where we can include both the joys and the sorrows of life without being knocked off course by either one.
Yeah.
Not grasping after, clutching at the joys, or fighting, or fleeing, or freezing, or appeasing, you know, the sorrows. And here, there's a story I heard, I think, you know, you weren't there, Chris, but I heard it from Kamala Masters, who's a teacher, and she was, it's in my book, so there's a little repetition here, but I heard her say it. She was in India, going down the Ganges, in, I think, Benares. I've never been to India. She was with her teacher, who's kind of regarded as a saint, Manindra, a Buddhist saint, who's no longer alive. And she's in this boat, an early morning kind of tour thing. The sun is rising, it's dawn. And she's holding his hand. She's with him. She's really grounded and present. And as she goes down, on her left, the rising sun is lighting these ancient towers of Benares that are just stunningly beautiful. You know, salmon light, golden light, perfectly still, perfectly quiet. You know, so wonderful, so beautiful, right? And on the other side of the Ganges, there are funeral pyres burning. She can smell human flesh being burned. Now, and hear the sound of the wailing of the relatives who are full of sorrow and grief, you know, the losses there. Right? Sunrise, joy on the left, death, grief on the right. And for her, equanimity was to have a heart that was big enough to contain both. That's the word. That's the aim of practice. It's to have that heart that's big enough to contain both. What feeds that kind of equanimity? It's deepening in gladness, love, and peace. So that even as you're there with the sunrise or there with the pyres, you recognize those are passing conditions. And your home base is gladness, love, and peace. Fruit is the path. One more. Yeah.
One implication of what you're saying.
Impatient?
Implication.
Oh, implication.
Seems to be that gladness, love, and peace are all kind of natural states of human beings. But on the other hand, meditation doesn't seem to be something that comes naturally to most human beings.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm asking is if there's any kind of absolute value to meditation, or if values in kind of beneficial side effects you get from practicing it. For instance, in the Soto Zen sect, practicing meditation is considered to have a kind of value in itself.
Yeah.
beneficial effects it has.
Right. Okay. If I understand the question, or really in the comment there, you're thinking about if gladness, love, and peace, if you will. And what I mean by those are just three words that just kind of summarize when the approaching system, the attaching system, and the avoiding system are at rest, when they're okay, when they're in their responsive mode. What's the basic experience like? It has this quality in it. And quick explanation, the reason I do it in this order is that this is the hardest one to get to, because this is the inner iguana. This is the lizard brain, the reptilian brain, the slowest to learn anything. All right, and I want to prime it by starting with gladness, love, and then we get to peace often. Sometimes people can start with peace, but often it really helps to feel fulfilled basically in terms of the goals and the approaching system, and then also a sense of belonging and closeness with others. And on the basis of that, then we're more able to feel safe, right? Because it's really, like you said earlier, there's this ongoing tickle of anxiety, this little trickle, endlessly going out to keep us, you know, looking around for leopards, lions, and tigers, and bears. Okay, so as to meditation, I think of meditation, I think that gladness, love, and peace really is the default setting, especially when we're not threatened, we're not hungry, we're not multitasking, we're not running around like chickens with our head cut off, which is to say, not all the time, right? Modern life is pretty much a drivenness away from home. It's interesting that in hunter-gatherer cultures, you know, in a hunter-gatherer culture, like the Bushmen of the Kalahari, how long it takes them to take care of all their needs, the equivalent for them of what we do to work, 4 hours a day. They take care of their bodily needs in 4 hours a day of hunting and gathering. The rest of the time, what are they doing? They're hanging out. They're making love. They're telling stories. They're sleeping. They're doing a lot of sleeping. All right? So they're, you know, we live in a culture that has kind of driven us from home for all of our modern enhancements and stuff. So that said, with regard to meditation, I think of meditation, and there are many kinds of meditation, as a specific practice where we train the mind. We deliberately train the mind. We take its basic capacity to focus attention deliberately, and then we use that capacity and we really build it out, and then we use that for other things as well. So now, is meditation a means to an end? I think it's a means to an end to the extent that it drops us into wholesome states of mind. By all accounts, what did the Buddha do after his enlightenment? He spent a lot of his day meditating. Right? He could do anything. He was in bliss. He could have done anything. He could have twiddled his thumb or, I don't know what, you know, done knitting or crochet. He meditated because it was worth doing in its own right. You know, he liked that. It's also the truth, though, that when we do some kind of practice where we step out of the stressful frenzy of the normal life, right there is beneficial. You know, the word that's often used around meditative practice in the Dharma is seclusion. It's a place of seclusion. Now, it could be a place of seclusion where you go off in the forest or a cave. But very often it's a place of seclusion where you just go into seclusion in your own mind. You say, right now, 1 minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I'm going to do this thing. We seclude ourselves. or we go on retreat for a week or more, or whatever, we seclude ourselves. I think that itself is enormously valuable, including implicitly, because we're taking a stance for ourselves. The other thing about it is that we train attentional capacities, and attention is probably the preeminent way to change the brain over time. Where do we rest attention? And the preeminent training of attention is mindfulness or meditation, more formally. The last thing I'll say is people really vary in what their goal, what their priorities are, what their aims are. Why do they do something? You know, honestly, for some people, it's to just get a moment of relief. You know, I my first book was about taking good care of mothers, and over the long haul, not just the postpartum period. And I think a lot of moms and dads as well, they just kind of hang out with the kid. That's meditation. You know, the child's sleeping. If you've ever had kids, and your infant is finally asleep, oh my God, that's like, sure, I'm in bliss. That's meditation right there. There are many kinds of meditation. What's the aim? Just respite, okay? That's a legitimate form of meditation, just respite. On the other hand, if you really have an interest, and what the Buddha said was the opportunity for everyone, male or female, householder or renunciate, you know, Brahmin or untouchable, the opportunity for all of us is full awakening. And getting to full awakening or getting fairly along that path, meditation is a preeminent tool to a penetrating understanding of the causes of suffering in the mind and the causes of liberation from suffering. And so we hone that tool. Maybe I'll leave you with this metaphor that's a traditional one. You may have heard it before. It's the idea that we find ourselves in a forest of ignorance and suffering, right? That's where we find ourselves. And we want to get to true happiness, true love, true wisdom. How do we do it? Well, we have to get a path out of the forest. Path out of the forest. First of all, the good news is we don't have to cut down the whole forest. We just have to find a path. How do we find the path? Well, it's said that if you want to cut your way through the forest, and this is, of course, a metaphor from, I think, from forest Buddhists, you know, meditators. They spend a lot of time in the forest. Imagine a razor blade or a stick. Well, a razor blade is sharp, but it doesn't have much oomph behind it. And a stick has a lot of oomph, but it's not sharp. What you need is a razor-sharp machete. You know, something that is both sharp and discerning, right? And distinguishes things. And also has some oomph behind it. So insight is the razor blade. Concentration is the weight of the stick. Right? And we develop both in meditation. And it's critically important to develop concentration, the heft. You know, when Buddhism came to the West, it came with a lot of esoteric teachings. People were very interested in the teachings. Feed me right now. Teach me, teach me. But they didn't develop the concentration that could apply that razor blade very effectively. That's why it's important to really train the steadying mind. All right. Compassion? All right. So, great quote from Pema Chodron talking about compassion, you know, and the heart of equanimity that Kama Masters talked about there, so big, so broad. But, of course, the root of compassion is self-compassion. You know? And yet, unfortunately, that's one of the last people we're compassionate for, isn't it? Ourselves. It's often hard to do. So I want to show you this slide, and then we'll talk about empathy. Compassion for oneself is a big area of research these days. A lot of the seeming benefits of self-esteem boil down to self-compassion. Arguably, self-compassion is more powerful because it's very felt. It's in the body, whereas self-esteem is more conceptual. I've known a number of people as a therapist who could give you a list of their good qualities, and they still felt like a worthless schmuck, right? Because they didn't feel it, you know. That's where self-compassion comes in. So if you want to help yourself or clients you work with, let's say, access self-compassion, there's some neurological tricks here, which are, first, bring to mind the felt sense of being cared about. Start by receiving, you know, fill the cup. Then, second, really sink into the experience of compassion for someone it's easy to feel compassion. Those two things really prime the circuits. They really light them up. And then we can move into compassion for other people. Okay? Self-compassion is very important. You know, my own kind of personal psychological first aid, when something is rattling me, or, you know, I get a letter in the mail that, like, whoa, or something is happening, it's, for me, it's kind of quick. It's pause, get on my own side. Actually, it's pause, self-compassion, get on my own side, make a plan. Pause means, you know, just buy yourself the gift of time. Get the gift of time. Give yourself the gift of time so you can see what's going on. Second, there's that initial movement of just self-compassion. This hurts. Ouch. I don't like this. Darn. Bummer. Poor little animal. Poor little Ricky. Little Ricky. And then get on your own side. It's like, I'm not going to take this lion down. I'm going to take up arms against my oppressors in here. Like, make this better for me. Okay, get on my own side. But it really fuels that to start with self-compassion. And then on the basis of that, figure out what to do. That's kind of quick first aid in the trenches. Listen to me. All right? Okay. I want to move into empathy and then into things we can do with those other people who really irritate us. Right? So empathy. Okay. This is good. You've probably seen this quote, you know. The Buddha really talked about action, relational action, and the way we act in relationship. You know, what's the mode of relating, if you will? Is it anger? Is it ill will? Is it envy? Is it schadenfreude? You know, or is it selfless giving? You know, the bliss of blamelessness, as he says. All right? Okay. So, empathy. What is empathy? Empathy fundamentally is sensing what it's like to be another person. And it involves, you know, a conceptual aspect to it and also a kind of resonance with other people. It's very fundamental in relationships, which is why I want to talk about it here, and because it's increasingly well understood in the brain in ways that have practical applications. Right? In Buddhist practice, empathy connects to wise view because, obviously, if we're not, if we don't recognize our connection with other people, which is embedded in wise view, we can't be empathic toward them. One reason why I'm emphasizing empathy is because, you know, I actually have had experience quite a few times in Buddhist circles where I feel like I'm on the receiving end of unempathic compassion. Kind of generic compassion, you know? Like, they want to be compassionate, but they can't be bothered to be empathic or something. And I think for real compassion or real kindness to have any kind of for it to be real, for it to have traction, it has to be founded in empathy. Empathy is three neural substrates in the brain, three major systems. In effect, when we're empathic, we simulate the inner world of other people. Okay? We might simulate their actions, or their emotions, or their thoughts. Thoughts broadly defined, including psychodynamics, tendencies, Myers-Briggs personality subtypes, whatever. You know, that's what we do. Okay? All three systems are important. Personally, I think that, and I'll tell you, I think, where is that? Yeah, anatomically. Actions, mirror systems, yeah, temporal parietal junction. The so-called mirror neurons or mirror networks are involved in simulating the actions of others. Let me explain what that means. So if you'll put up with this for a second, imagine that you're reaching for a cup. So please reach for a cup. Just do that gesture. You reach for a cup. You got that cup. Good. Pull your hand back. No more cup. Okay, now watch me reach for the cup. All right. Roughly 10% of the same neurons inside your head that lit up when you reached for the cup also lit up when you saw me reach for the cup. Hence the term mirroring. It's a very efficient way to give our animal ancestors a sense from the inside out of what the intentions are of predators and prey, or members of their own band. Because if you watch them do something, and you get a sense inside yourself of what it feels like yourself to do that thing, it gives you a sense from the inside out of what they're about. It's very efficient. Same thing happens with the insula. The insula, as I said earlier, is a part of the brain that tunes into emotions inside ourselves. Well, again, if you're having a deep feeling, let's say sadness or joy, right? A very, particularly an embodied kind of feeling. A bunch of neurons light up in your insulin. If you then see someone else having that feeling, roughly, again, some fraction of those same neurons light up as well. In effect, you're having an echo, a resonance, a hint of what it's like to be that other person. Theory of mind is more abstract. It's where people basically develop more of a sense of the interior world of other people. Little children tend not to have that sense. It starts coming online around age 4 or so. Prior to that, it's often hard for them to kind of get it, that other people can see the world differently than themselves. Theory of mind really fulfills itself toward the end of adolescence or in early adulthood when the myelination of the prefrontal cortex completes. Remember I talked about myelination moving from the back to the front. Okay? That's empathy. So I'll say more. We'll do a practice with empathy in a second. So empathy skills. There's some basic skills for empathy. And I think it's really worth thinking about this in yourself and with other people. Understanding these skills is good for oneself, and it helps us ask for empathy from others more clearly. All right? So eyes are, you know, the windows of the soul. They're a very, very deep source of empathic understanding. If you think about humans, the human species, we have the most expressive eyes of any animal. Because to really have an expressive eye, you need to have a lot of distinction between the corona, whatever the actual circle, and the white around it. Other primates don't have much white. If you think about looking at a gorilla, there's not much white around the eyes. Also pupils. As pupils dilate, as they expand or contract, you know, it's more, it's clearer what people feel, basically. Where they expand with something positive, typically, and they contract with something negative. All right. So the eyes are very, very expressive. I think it's also important, and I'll just bounce off a couple of these here, to realize that empathy is not agreement. Not agreement. We often think that if we empathize with someone, we're waiving our rights, or we're, you know, we're agreeing with them, or we're approving of them. Not so at all. You know, if we're empathic, it just means we're entering their world. I can feel empathic. I can imagine what it's like. You know, like to use an example, Saddam Hussein, Iraq War. His sons were killed fairly early on in the invasion of Iraq. And he himself, after he hid out for a while, I think roughly several weeks, he was captured and so forth, ultimately hung. I can imagine what it might be like for Saddam, you know, to have lost his sons. I still think, personally, you know, that he was a ruthless and terrible dictator, killed a lot of innocent people in his country. But I can still imagine, wow, what it would be like to realize that his, in some ways his own actions led to the events that led to the death of his sons. You know, what would be that like? What would that be like? So we can be empathic without giving up our rights. Okay, so any questions about empathy before we do a practice about it?
Is empathy then something to do with what might be regarded as attachment theory, that it's something that's learned from the mother in early childhood, which also affects the brain and all?
Yeah. Okay, so what's the relationship between empathy and attachment theory, right? Well, the idea is that if a child, for example, is receiving a lot of empathic attunement, that is critically important in promoting optimal development. And if a child lacks empathic attunement growing up, or there are major breaches of empathic attunement, that creates issues, like a hole in the heart. And most people have a hole in the heart. You know, my wife is, I think there's some percentage, I don't know what it is, 5 or 10%, who grew up in a truly benign home. She did. She was, like, you know, fortunate. Yeah, well, that's right. In attachment theory, it's about 40% are insecurely attached. But even of the securely attached, I think a fair number of them, you know, have got some dings, you know, and bruises. But that said, but the point is that later on in life, you can really go after the targeted supplies to feed that hole in your heart, even if you didn't get the kind of nurturing, secure attachment-promoting experiences that were really optimal in childhood. And that's where it helps to know what's your personal vitamin C. In other words, if you have scurvy, you could give a person all the vitamin A or iron or protein or meatballs or whatever in the world. It won't solve their problem. They need fruits and vegetables. They need vitamin C for scurvy. Well, a lot of us have our own particular antidote experiences for relationship wounds, let alone other wounds, right? And then what's useful is to know what would be a reparative experience for you, and then go look for that experience, or even create that experience out in life as your critical vitamin C. And then when you have that experience, really, really take it in. Gradually, gradually fill the hole in your heart.
And in a sense, that's what therapy is about.
It is, and life too. Yeah, therapy is a great way to fill the hole in the heart. As a therapist, I'm very interested in the other 187 hours in the week, you know, when they're not in my office, right? And the rest of their life and so forth. But really, do not doubt the ability of healing yourself, particularly if you go after your own vitamin C and really, really, you know, a handful of times each day, feel it, typically in very mild ways, and then let it really, really sink in. Yeah. Other things on empathy? Yeah.
Emotions resonate, mirroring. I'm just thinking about what the mechanism is that. I mean, like, if you're happy and I feel happy, how is that? Is it information getting passed in between us? And what's the medium to which it passes? And I think there have been studies showing that when with mothers and babies, that those neurons are actually starting at the same time.
Yeah. Okay, so we have two things here then. We have empathy and then we have regulation. Empathy is very receptive in its basic nature. You know, I'm resonating with your actions. I'm resonating with your emotions. I'm resonating with your thoughts, in effect. I'm simulating. I'm getting a sense of what it's like to be in your skin. Right? That's receptive. It hasn't yet moved into regulation. So I'm just making the distinction. Okay, good. So now, receiving empathy is calming, isn't it? See, very often, what do we want from other people? We want them to give us what we want, right? But we mostly want them to get what we want. We want them to understand it. We want them to know it. What do you, you know, like you send a message, you want to know message received. You want to know that they got it, that it landed. So, in a funny way, giving empathy to other people, which is a wonderful thing to do because you don't waive your rights, and it gives you all kinds of practical information about those other people, whether it's in a family environment or a sales environment or a work environment. You know, empathy is great because you can really tune into people, but also it's a great gift to them that kind of calms them down. You know, in an intimate relationship, very often what people really want is empathy. One thing I learned when we had kids was the critical importance of starting with joining. That became my mantra. You know, again, maybe coincidentally because I'm male, maybe not. But start by joining rather than detached, analytical problem solving. Right? Okay? And so very often that alone is all that's needed. All kinds of relationship issues go away when people just tune into each other. Like, imagine a person you're with right now, or a person in your life is a difficult person, and there's some sort of a struggle there. Imagine what it would be like if that person just took the blue pill, you know, like in Matrix, right? Instead of the red pill, took the blue pill, and just gave you 5-10 minutes straight, complete empathy, total presence, no resistance. Not agreement, not necessarily agreeing with you, but complete openness and receptivity. What would that do to your experience with that person? Flip the other way. Think of people in your life that maybe have some kind of difficulty with you. And you can feel a certain resistance to them. Maybe a certain aversion, or you feel like they're trying to suck you dry. They're like human vampires, you know, little mosquitoes, human mosquitoes, drinking your blood, whatever. And instead, you just imagine what would happen in that relationship if I just relaxed and gave that person my mind for 10 minutes straight. I suspect that other person would feel a lot better, a lot calmer, a lot cooler, and so forth. Just point in passing. And then to complete on regulation and then go here, So empathy itself is regulating, and it gives us information about regulation. Now, we regulate each other in lots of ways, okay? And parents and infants, parents regulate infants, but of course infants regulate parents. It's a two-way street. It's very much a bi-directional street. A lot of research. My background a lot is in early childhood, actually, 0 to 3. I love that era, age a lot because they don't have language yet, so it's really interesting. You know, the root of the word infant means without speech. They don't have language yet. So anyway, it's a really great age. I did my dissertation on 15-month-olds. So I really was really into that age and younger. So my point is that we do regulate infants, okay, and it goes the other way as well. But a lot of that regulation is not just through mirroring. I think, honestly, the whole mirror neuron thing is way overplayed. And other people think that, too, not just me. There's so much more to empathy than mirroring action. Action's almost trivial as far as empathy is concerned. Where the real action is in empathy is in emotions and thoughts, right? Yeah, looking at the previous slide. So, to sum up, and I'm not, I think I'm getting at your question. I may not be zeroing in entirely. I think that the process of regulation happens in all kinds of ways. We are tuned into each other, although people really vary. And I think that lots of times we regulate each other in ways that are very ordinary, through language. We talk. You know, it's when things get troubled that I think what really starts working, especially in an important relationship, is moving into deeper and deeper kinds of resonance, where maybe we touch the person if it's not inappropriate, you know, or we start matching their postures at a very elemental level, or especially we try to feel down beneath the surface. This is the latest practice this week in my Just One Thing, to see the being behind the eyes, you know, to sense the being behind the eyes. My mom, very loving, no longer alive, is one of those people with a huge heart and a complex and sometimes difficult personality. Do you ever have a relative like that? Can't remember? Maybe a child, who knows? And bugged me a long time. What I finally learned to do for myself that really helped me is I just began to presume the being behind her eyes. I sensed it. And I imagined it, visual guy, as if her personality were a latticework with lots of vines on it, like blackberries with thorns and leaves and twigs. But through the latticework shining toward me, I could see this warm fire of her heart, that she always loved me. And she did. She always did love me. I knew that. And so sometimes even particularly when she was being particularly difficult, to help myself, because I was on my own side, hopefully, I would just call up the felt sense of that fire back there, and I'd kind of ignore the rest. You know? Like, see the being behind the eyes. Okay, maybe actually one more person that I want to do a practice with you. Make it experiential, yeah.
Sometimes I feel like I get lost in empathy, and I almost take on the other person's emotions too much, and so I'm not giving up my rights, but
yeah, a little bit like you're getting at. She was getting at over there. Almost an emotional contagion is the phrase that's often used. Paradoxically, to be empathic, it really helps to have good fences. You know the saying, good fences make for good neighbors? And so it can often help to deliberately do things to have a greater sense of distance from the other person. You know, there's a saying in developmental psychology, distance in the service of attachment. We distance in order to stay connected. Right, and so I'll visualize myself things like a glass wall between me and the other person, so that I can stay present with them, you know, or just a picket fence or something like that. What also helps in terms of this is to focus on your own body sensations. That helps reground us over here. That's another one that's really good. Another one for me is visual. I literally imagine sometimes being a big tree. I like the woods, you know. I'm a hobbity kind of guy, deep down, really, actually. You know, so there you are, the tree. You're the oak tree, right? You're deep, you're strong. And the wind is blowing, including their stuff. Whatever it is, they could be mad at you, right? It could be real intense. But there you are, and you can let the wind blow through. right? And at the end of the day, you're still there. That can be another way to help one be more empathic. Yeah. The other thing, too, is to not take responsibility for their bad day. In other words, to in the traditional phrase, think of the 10,000 causes upstream that are flowing through that person right there. You know, causes of their genetics, their gender, their life history, their parents, their grandparents, their great-great-grandparents, all the causes streaming through them right there, almost none of which have your name tag on them. Right? That's also another way to be empathic, to just kind of stay. That's what equanimity is a lot, is to recognize that they are the source, generally speaking, of much of, you know, what's happening to them in their life, as well as there are other factors that they're not the source of, but you're not the source either. Okay? So I propose we do a practice. If you're willing, are you okay with doing something in pairs? Really, if you can opt out, you don't have to do it. Are you willing to do it, basically, something in pairs? That's Mars right here. Landscape on Mars. Oh, well. Mars has clouds, too. Okay. What do you think about doing something in pairs? Is that not... That's not an anathema? All right, that's okay. Just check in. Just culture varies, you know. You want to... It's all right. Okay. Okay, so in a moment, I'm going to suggest that you form a dyad. Pick a partner. If you want to opt out, it's really okay. Pick an A and a B. A's will go first. So basically, there'll be a listener and a talker, mainly. Talkers can pause, and listeners can ask questions, but mainly listen or mainly talk. And what I'd like you to do is play around with being really deliberately empathic. Okay? So probably the person you're going to be with is someone you don't know. If you came here with someone you do know, it's probably a great person to do this with. And it's really okay to pick up the chairs, move around, try not to knock over cups and stuff like that, so they'll let us come back, you know, sometime in the future. Spread around the room. You go about 5 minutes each way. All right? I'll give you a time signal. And if you can, check out these empathy skills. And in particular, try to tune into the actions of the other person, their stance, their body, their posture, their facial expressions. That's that sort of action system. Also try to sense the deeper feelings, like the softer, more vulnerable feelings beneath anger or the story. People will give you their story. Try to sense beneath the surface. What are they really feeling deep down? What are they really wanting deep down? Okay? And also try to imagine what's going on in their head. Why are they feeling that way? What else could be in the mix? Maybe even ask some questions in your mind. Hypothesis testing. What's going on here? These are all functions of empathy. And if you do them, you really, really work these systems. You work those three muscles. All right? So far? So if you're the speaker now, you know, protect your privacy. I think privacy is really important. I know I live in the west coast of America, a very new age place. People just tell you unbelievable things. As my kids say, TMI, Dad, too much information. Alright, so really don't tell anybody anything you don't want to tell. On the other hand, if you talk about something that's important to you, and it could be positive, oftentimes you think about things only for negative. It's also for positive, right? There's a place for positive empathy. Anyway, if you can, talk about something that's pretty meaningful, maybe even something that you're dealing with that's tough these days, that you're willing to share. You get the basic idea? Okay? Alright, so everybody find a partner, spread out. You're going to probably need to grab some chairs or turn where you are. Try to keep your voices kind of quiet. Force it on the ground.